Yes. The meeting will come to order. There is a quorum present. Representative Cass, would you like to move the minutes?
So move, Madam Chair.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
No. Minutes are approved. I think we'll have Representative Doty explain it.
Madam Chair, I can explain why we're bringing this bill back. This is the department's housekeeping bill that we had passed last week, but I found out after we passed it that anything that changes a task force or board must go to state and local government operations, and rather than making the motion on the floor, we thought we'd bring it back and reconsider it here and send it to state and local government.
So, Madam Chair, with that in mind, I move to reconsider House File 710.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Do I have to remove this?
Okay. And Madam Chair, I move that House File 710 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Doty, for doing that. I believe I believe that Bill Martin and John Jaffe are going to come up to thank you. We'll just continue our clean water discussion from Monday, and I don't know which one of you want to speak first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Martin. I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And today, if you'll, hopefully in your package, you'll find a handout that says, first page says PATH, MDA Efforts, Clean Water Legacy, and it's dated 2/24. And what I'd like to do is just talk briefly and go over the handout of the role that the department has played in past Clean Water Legacy projects, and then move into the new proposed projects under the Clean Water Fund. Everything goes by many different names, but we tend to say Clean Water Legacy is the past and the Clean Water Fund is the future, and that's the money coming from the sales tax amendment. And I know we talked about this earlier today in Ag Finance, but we also have John Jaffe here from Board of Water and Soil Resources. So if there's questions more about on-the-ground projects and how the MDA's work links up with the Board of Water and Soil Resources work, we can have that discussion too.
Okay.
So please, the Chair.
Thank you. Just continue on.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, thanks for the opportunity to go over the MDA's past and future roles with clean water. I'm sure this is the first of many times you'll hear about this. As those of you that are on the environment committees or the dedicated committees will be hearing more of the agency's requests in terms of the Clean Water Fund. And to be most succinct, I guess I'll just refer to the sheet in terms of the past efforts of the Department of Agriculture in terms of clean water legacy. It's basically three functions that we've had. The biggest function has been the Ag BMP loan program. And these have been, Ag BMP loan program's been around since 1995. It's been funded with two sources, either direct legislative appropriations or annual public facility authorities allocations. And this is a loan program that we partner with local units of government and local lenders. Our primary role is to work with local units of government, whether it be counties or SWCDs, to identify which projects they're going to work on, and then we decide an allocation for them to work on projects that ultimately benefit clean waters. The second role that we've had in the past is research efforts. And how I like to explain what we're doing on research is, well, we spent a lot of time dealing with impaired waters. There's still considerable knowledge gaps out there. We know that agriculture contributes to impairments, but many times we don't know exactly how much. And when we do know that there's an agriculture contribution, the even more difficult question is what really needs to be done on the landscape and where to improve the water quality. So we've initiated several research projects with the University of Minnesota to try to address some of those questions that will help us in the future dealing with impaired waters. I believe also in your handout there is a detailed list of those research projects, of the researchers, the dollar amounts, and the status of those projects. The last part of our past work has been general technical assistance efforts. And when I say technical assistance, we usually mean staff or special projects. We've done two special projects. One project has been to working with the Minnesota milk producers and the pork producers in terms of developing private sector environmental quality assurance programs. And this is an effort where we're trying to use the private sector to work with the producer members in evaluating the conservation problems on their farms and the practices that they need to implement. And that's been, I believe, a successful program, and hopefully it will have legs in the future. The second effort that we embarked upon was working with the U of M Water Resource Center to train conservation professionals. And this is also a private-public sector effort in terms of getting more people, trained professionals on the ground that can interact with producers in terms of what they may need to do on their operations to improve environmental stewardship. The last amount that we've used is we have reassigned one existing staff member who is now primarily full-time working on impaired waters issues. As with all of this work, it takes a considerable amount of oversight, overseeing the research project, evaluating TMDL plans, looking at monitoring data. So that's an addition, and we have used some resources for that one person. If there isn't any questions on our past efforts, I can move right into our proposed future efforts with the Clean Water Fund.
I'll ask, are there any other questions or comments before he moves on?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, turning in, you'll see the page titled Future MDA Efforts Clean Water Fund. This it parallels our past efforts with a few differences. Obviously, the first request and the biggest request is continuation of the Ag BMP loan program. As we have more TMDL plans developed, there's going to be increased workload on local units of government to actually do on-the-ground projects. You'll hear more about that from Mr. Jaski, how this program matches up with some of the work that FWCDs may be doing. But you'll see the request in terms of getting more money out to local units to work on loans. Primarily, the loans we're looking at are would be feedlot fixes or septic tank system replacements and conservation tillage. The second request is there's several items in the request, but it's lumped together. This could either be staff costs, where obviously we have one person on right now to maintain that staff and potentially add 1 to 1.5 additional FTEs. Also to have a competitive research process again, where we don't pretend to know all of the answers or what projects will rise to the top, but setting a portion of money aside for a competitive process in terms of research efforts, and then also to do some unique pilot projects or demonstration farms, because we all know that we need to put some things on the ground that people can come and visually see what's working, because a picture or doing something on the ground tells a million words, especially to producers. They want to see it work before they change that practice on their farm. So that's in terms of that request. The last two requests are new requests that these are efforts that were not done in the past, the Clean Water Legacy. In terms of drinking water protection, the amendment did call out a certain amount of dollars to be used for drinking water. The primary role of the Department of Agriculture in drinking water is we do have regulatory authority over nitrogen. And we know that there are certain areas of the state that have nitrate problems in groundwater. And we do some limited work in working with a limited amount of communities that have had problems in the past. But there's certainly more we could do. And what this request would go to is working with more communities or private homeowners that may be experiencing nitrate problems in their groundwater. And then the last part is additional work in terms of pesticide monitoring and assessment. We do a lot of pesticide work, and that's primarily funded out of our pesticide regulatory account and the fees that are collected for it. And as many of you know, we are proposing a fee increase for those efforts. But this is somewhat separate. What this appropriation would go to is the main bottleneck that we have in terms of pesticide monitoring is laboratory work. We need special equipment so we can run more water samples, and this would go towards purchase of laboratory equipment where we could do a lot more additional water monitoring so we can actually know where there are problems and respond accordingly. Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks.
Are there any other questions? Comments?
On this one.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. John Gaffney, Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. As Martin explained, I'm going to give you kind of a snapshot of the number of kinds of things that we do with our programs focused on agricultural landscapes. I just want to make sure you have the same document I have. On Monday when we were here, we had given this colored version of this presentation, so I want to make sure if you got that in your packet, then we'll follow along with that with page numbers so I can thing off the same sheet of music that you're looking at. So to begin then, on the bottom of page one, these are a number of policies that are in place related to water and water management that relate to agricultural settings. I didn't cover them all, but I wanted to highlight a few. The first is the local water management authorities that counties, soil and water conservation districts, and watershed districts carry out under various statutes. They get input from landowners and other interests and put together plans to address water quality, flooding, groundwater, etc., all the water issues that apply in their jurisdiction. As Mr. Martin indicated, Minnesota Statute 114 is the statute that establishes the Clean Water Legacy Act that happened in 2006, and in that act it identifies really two main kinds of pollution sources. Point source comes out of a pipe, to keep it simple, and non-point source is the unidentifiable individual sources that come off of landscapes. It also established a Clean Water Council, which includes a number of organizations, including agriculture, to make recommendations on how to deal with our water quality concerns. And we've had in place a number of regulatory programs over the years that have the purpose of providing protection for our water resources. And finally, the last point there is that, you know, as Mr. Martin indicated, this Clean Water Fund, as we're now referring, is now referred to in the Constitution, 33% of those funds go to clean water purposes. And Mr. Martin went through some of the details of the MDA's proposals for using portions of that funding. I will not do that. We have a similar list of programs that will be going through the Environment Natural Resources Committee, and if you want to hear more about that at some point, I can sure come back and give you those details. On to page two, just a little bit of a background on our agency. We focus on the private lands, of course, which is where our agricultural landscapes certainly are, and we use local governments, those counties, watershed districts, and soil water conservation districts, to deliver the conservation and clean water program at that local level. Our agency, in the bottom of page two, is organized with a board. We have members from local governments, citizens, and state agencies, including MVA, and Mr. Martin sits on our board as representative of MVA. We have staff, 75 staff approximately in 8 offices around the state, and we provide the statutory oversight and coordination with those local government units that are managing our water resources. On the top of page 3 is just an example of one of those plans. Typically, they run from 5 to 10 years, and they have they provide the bridge between the science and the citizens to show us what we need to do, where we need to do it, and how best to achieve those water management objectives, you know, related to water quality, flood control, and so on and so forth. They all have a common denominator, which is they're managing on a watershed basis. If you look at the bottom of page 3, we're trying to do this on a variety of scales, from small sub-watersheds within an urban area to large pieces of the state, which are divided into basins. The scale of these watershed efforts and these plans are different, but they all have the same purpose, which is to achieve clean water across that landscape. On page 4, you can see at the top of page 4 just a couple of examples of the scale differences. On the right, you can see there's plans that have been put in place nationally to deal with the entire Mississippi River drainage as it relates to the Gulf of Mexico. But then on the left, you see we have a very much more focused plan dealing with one specific small watershed in a portion of Dakota and Scott County on one particular water quality parameter. On the bottom of page 4, the reality is that those plans utilize, regardless of scale, 3 different tools to achieve their outcomes. A combination of education, of projects that we use to get achieve restoration on the landscape, and some combination of regulation that is needed to preserve or, in some cases, restore when development occurs. Those 3 tools are what these plans prescribe for how to best tackle those issues. And, of course, they're all based on data and the citizen input to that process. On page 5, just a couple more examples. This is the area that smaller plan scale that I talked about in Dakota and Scott County. It's a multi-county project or program, just as many of these watershed projects are, either through joint powers agreements or through the formation of watershed districts. On the bottom of page 5 is a plan that is just a 1 page from the Stearns County Stormwater Conservation District, where they're using this data, and you can't, of course, see all the details there, but this identifies the most important critical areas for protection efforts in their county based on the data that they have. On the top of page 6, it goes all the way right down to the field level, because if we don't get it into the landowner's arena, we aren't going to be successful. We have to be able to work with landowners, and that's why we use our local governments to achieve that. And here you can see an example of a plan that has been prepared for this particular landowner as a possible way of dealing with some of the water management topics on their property, you know, for habitat, water quality, and flood control. Representative Junkie actually has a bill and talks about doing a lot more of this in a bigger way, and we've got to think about how to make the best use of limited resources we have to get good plans, but also make sure we got enough money to do projects. And so we're always constantly challenged with trying to do the least we can on the paper and do the most we can on the ground, and that's what these local plans are really all about. The bottom of page 6, just the model that we use is to get state and federal funding combined and getting it to the local governments who then work with landowners to get those outcomes that I referred to at the bottom of page 6 in that lower slide there, the number of different benefits that we get with these projects. On the top of page 7, a little bit more detail, our state conservation cost share program is the one that has focused on these kinds of projects you see here. You've got a erosion problem in the upper left that are in an agricultural field. On the lower left, you see an area that's been flooded because the channel, the water came out of the channel and went over the cropped area. We might look at putting a riparian buffer in there, maybe a waterway in that upper left picture. You see in the center of that picture a lakeshore area that's got a need for some additional protection to prevent erosion on that area. And then in the lower right, there's a project that we spend some time on with feedlots, where you've got an open area there where the animals are close proximity to the water with potential for a pollution problem. And so these are the kinds of problems that program deals with. And as Mr. Martin indicated, These projects are funded with a combination of state and federal funding, but also the landowner is required to put a portion of their funding into these as well. And one of the ways that this, the Ag BMP program works is to provide the financing for that landowner contribution to those other public funds. The bottom of page 7, these are some of the solutions that you see that may be part of the package when we get right down to those individual landowner sites. Riparian buffers in the upper left along those riparian corridors where we have ditches and streams and lakes. In the center there you see the bioretention project along the lakeshore. In the lower left, the agricultural setting again where we've got a great stabilization project which provides, you know, some flood control and some water quality benefits. And then on the right-hand side, you see the practices that the producer is doing to maximize the both the conservation value of that land, the conservation tillage, and also the contour cropping. The conservation tillage is one of those practices that in the last decade or two has become the norm as opposed to you know, the experimental approach. And it's not done just for conservation purposes, but also for managing the soil and the moisture in the soil, because it's been proven over and over again that conservation tillage in most every case can provide the landowner, the producer, with a reduced amount of risk with drought, and can, if they're irrigating, provide some savings in terms of pumping and having to irrigate to keep their crop production maximized. The top of page 8, there's a vast network, as most of you know, in the state, of drainage systems that have been constructed, most of them in agricultural settings, to manage that water over the last century. In the last few years, Bowser and in concert with the Department of Ag and others have put together a drainage management team to develop adjustments to policy as relates to drainage, as well as provide assistance to those drainage authorities, the local governments, the counties and watershed districts who are responsible for making the most of those systems, with a renewed focus, or a new focus perhaps, on water quality is one of the things that they're responsible for that they initially hadn't been, you know, a century ago when these systems were first established. The bottom of page 8 shows, you know, some of the ways that it's supposed to be done and some of the ways that it's not. Those drainage systems have, they go right through crop production areas, and maintaining and or installing and maintaining a buffer area is an important part of making sure those systems are stable, that the ditch systems, you know, they're paid for by the producers, and if that system is needing regular and frequent maintenance, they're going to be paying much more for that, as well as, of course, the water quality concerns that some of those sites also pose if they aren't properly managed. Top of page 9, we have some more innovative ways of managing these drainage systems as well. This site in the top of page 9 is in Swift County, and there you've got a two-stage system where you create a meandering channel which helps for water quality purposes at the low stage level, but when the water comes in there during a flooding event or a large snowmelt runoff, there's the full capacity to ditch above that low level to transmit that water through the system. And so trying to balance both things in one site, there have been many research projects done that are now paying dividends in terms of getting practical projects accomplished that can allow the land to be productive, but also make sure we can manage our water quality and attenuate our flooding problems in those areas as well. On the bottom of page 9, we have responsibility for the soils resources in the state as well, and we've got a state soils office that we established with the University of Minnesota. Most of you know that the soil that we use in this state is maybe in some ways our most important resource, because it's what we grow our food on. It's where we may be going more of our energy on in the future, and protecting and preserving and sustaining that soil is important. And so some of the research that's being done, you know, tells us how to deal with potential compaction issues, tilth, et cetera, and making sure those soils are going to be long-term sustainable and productive. On the top of page 10, getting into a few more of just the more conservation-oriented endeavors, a couple of wetland restorations that have been established under our Reinvest in Minnesota program. That program's been around for 23 years now, and we've restored, I think we've got about 5,000 conservation easements around the state, and these are done on a voluntary basis by landowners who are interested in putting a restoration on their property in exchange for that payment for that conservation easement. The top one shows a system that was restored at the upper end of a drainage area to get that flood storage and water quality. That's usually the most preferable place to put these. But we also have one there at the bottom of that same top slide on page 10, the one that was restored actually in conjunction with a functioning public ditch. So we were able to get some water quality treatment and flood control benefits with a wetland that was restored basically parallel to the ditch, and we had a control structure on each end of that wetland that allowed the water to come in there and then back out into the ditch system under certain flow events. On the bottom of page 10, there's a site that is not yet restored but will be sometime beginning this year. This is in the Carver County, adjacent to Lake Waconia. You can see the drainage system that was constructed through that former wetland, and they actually used a pump to move the water from this wetland into Lake Waconia, and the landowner, or two landowners actually, agreed that they were interested in putting this wetland back, and you know, that'll certainly provide some benefits to the lake and the surrounding watershed that drains into that wetland. All of our wetlands have some amount of upland area that's restored in adjacent fashion with the wetland. In this case, it's going to be a fairly limited area, but in other cases, we have a larger area depending on the lay of the land and the land ownership, because we have to work, again, with willing landowners. On the top of page 11 is just another picture which shows kind of a before and after of an area. You know, these wetlands are restored on marginal lands. They were wetlands, and so they have always had a history often of, you know, challenging crop production in and around them, and so they're marginal for ag production, and these are the areas that we target. You can see in this site, again, we work with the landowner's parcel so that we can allow them to farm their operation, you know, fairly conveniently around that site. Many of them simply involve, you know, breaking some old tile lines, and once in a while we put a structure in, and of course doing the planting of the aquatic and the upland species adjacent to those areas. Last year, we were able to do about 9,700 acres of these areas in a partnership with the USDA, where they use their WRP program, or Wetland Reserve Program, to partner with our State Reinvest in Minnesota program to enroll these acres with willing landowners. And we have a very high demand. We were able to only fund about a third of those that had expressed interest during a very short 3-week incentive period. So we're hoping to do more of that again this year if the funding is available. On the bottom of page 11, we've also, based on some legislation that was passed last year, we are allowing landowners who have these easements to, you know, spend some more effort on both bioenergy production if they're interested, allowing some of that land to be harvested for that purpose, you know, in a way that doesn't compromise the water quality or habitat benefits, and also to utilize some of those areas to regenerate some native seed so we can use that seed in other places to restore other lands nearby. On the bottom of, or top of page 12, is that we've got much more ability now to target specific areas where you have water quality needs or habitat needs. Our local governments have these tools in their offices. Most of them are on their desktops. It allows them to be very efficient with their targeting of where they're going to work with willing landowners. And these are just some examples of both riparian areas as well as wetland restoration sites.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back up to the top slide on page 11 for a second here. Mm-hmm. The last section talks about $15 million in USDA funds that are available if state dollars for RIM are available. Mm-hmm. Do you gentlemen know if those were in the budget?
Madam Chair and Representative Doty, it is being considered right now as part of the LaSalle Outdoor Heritage Council process for funding under that dedicated portion of the habitat component, or the outdoor heritage component. It was funded last year out of the bonding appropriation, and at this point, you know, there's some consideration being given for funding there as well, but that's still a uncertainty at this point.
So,
Representative Doty?
Madam Chair, to be sure I understand, it was funded last year through bonding, and this year we are requesting it through LaSalle Council new funding.
Madam Chair and Representative Doty, that is correct.
Thank you.
Continue.
Okay. Just back to the page 12 then, and the bottom of page 12, I just wanted to list here, you know, some of the multiple benefits that we get from these wetland restoration sites and riparian buffers. I've talked about them already, but, you know, certainly nutrient reduction is one of those, especially as it helps us manage some of our potential nitrate problems in groundwater-sensitive areas, or in some cases surface water, but we also, you know, we more recently identified carbon sequestration as a potentially important function that these areas can also provide. You know, we talked about the biofuel production possibilities going into the future. On page 13, just another picture kind of showing a project that has some of these multiple benefits. This one, it happens to be up in Clay and Norman County, sponsored by a watershed district in concert with the Soil and Water District as well. You can see that this channel, which, you know, had been straightened and turned into more of a ditch, has now been reestablished or re-meandered within that same corridor. And we take a conservation easement over that that wide corridor through that system. In some cases, they actually will put in setback levees to provide even more flood protection if the landscape is amenable to it. And then you can see, looking downstream, the very top right corner of that picture, there's a wetland restoration that's been accomplished on that system as well. And that wetland restoration has a flood control outlet so that it can be lowered when, you know, and prior to you know, the spring runoff, and then put back, and then the wetland will refill, and then it can be, again, typically lowered late in the fall after the nesting and the migration season's over, so the waterfowl aren't affected by it, and you can use it for both habitat, water quality, and flood control purposes. On the bottom of page 13, this is just one example. We require our local governments to keep track of each project that they do, where it is, what it costs, and the actual conservation or water quality benefits that come from that. If any of you are interested in how these kinds of outcomes are being done in your own area, you can let me know and we can put together some information for you on those sorts of things. This is a statewide map, and of course, when you do that, it makes it look like everything's already been done because the dots are so large, they cover the whole landscape. But there's quite a bit more to do, obviously, and we'll be talking more, you'll be hearing more, I'm sure, about how we are going to be addressing our water quality needs going forward for the next at least 25 years. And finally, in here on page 14, I just wanted to highlight this study, and I'm not going to do it justice by boiling it down to the few points that are in here, but if you are interested in more information about this, there's contact information in the material. We've been doing these riparian restorations for a number of years now. We asked the U.S. Geological Survey if they would be interested in doing some study to see if we could actually compare and contrast watersheds where we had quite a bit of this work done compared to those where we didn't, that were similar, and see what the results were going to show us. They spent mostly federal money. The LCCMR actually put some money into it as well. And on page 15, there were three smaller scale watersheds chosen, all in the Minnesota River basin area. And they chose these three because they had similar landscapes and similar size. And they used one as the control, and that happened to be the South Branch of the Rush River. And that watershed had very little, you know, riparian land that had been put into conservation. The Chitamba Creek site had quite a bit of it, all basically in buffer areas along the channel, and then the West Fork of the Beaver Creek had more of a mixture of lands that were up into the watershed as well as some along the creek. And I'm going to, you know, make this real straightforward for you, hopefully, but there's more details that you want them, as I mentioned. But the slide on page 16 basically showed that we got the most water quality benefit, and we'll come to the details on that in a minute, with conservation or land retirement closest to these stream and channel corridors. So the first 50 feet was the most beneficial, and 100 feet, of course, has more benefit, but it's a diminishing return on the land retirement. And so you can see that at the bottom of page 16, this is kind of a model of what that might look like, where you've got those lands that are marginal adjacent to the channel in a permanent conservation cover, and that's where you get the greatest water quality benefit. And the slide on the top of page 17 happens to just show One of the parameters, probably the most important one in some ways, is IBI, which is the Index of Biological Integrity. What that measures is we call them critters, but the macro invertebrates that are lowest on the food chain, the things that the fish and the waterfowl are eating, their health is a very straightforward and highly correlated indicator of the water quality parameters, the physical parameters like turbidity, and other phosphorus, etc. And so if we have a high IBI score, that's indicative of a high water quality across a variety of different physical parameters. And you can see that the land retired adjacent to the stream provided increases in that food chain support, which means we've got higher water quality and, of course, the habitat that also is coming with that. So, very short summary, but it's a very recently completed study that I think was indicative of the things that we're going to be trying to do more of in the future on clean water. So, with that, Madam Chair, members, I will close and stand for any more questions or comments.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Jeske. I'm very appreciative of the hard work that you all have been doing, certainly in my district, and now I have a better sense of what you all have been doing around the state. Members, I did ask in our previous meeting about the Swamp Buster situation and the potential for a memorandum of understanding among Bowser and NRCS. I understand now the Army Corps of Engineers may not be at the table, but could you give us an update? This is a member trying to streamline the permitting process under, well, I'll let Mr. Jaffe explain and give us an update of where we might be.
Madam Chair, Representative Marl, what you're referring to is there's a wetland protection program. The state has the Wetland Conservation Act, which has been established since the early 1990s to protect wetlands. The U.S. Department of Agriculture since 1985 has included what's known as the Swamp Buster provision in the Federal Farm Bill. So if you're receiving Federal Farm Program benefits, you are required to not be draining wetlands to generate more land for crop production is a simple way to describe it, but there's a lot more details than that. As Representative Morrow indicated, we used to have a fairly straightforward way to coordinate those two programs back in the 90s when they first began. One of the things that happened in the most, not the most recent Farm Bill, but the 2000 Farm Bill that was passed in Washington is they, for good reasons, needed to tighten up the detailed information that these producers have to give to USDA to get these farm payments, including, income and other private matters. And so that information had previously been fully public, and so they changed it so that it was private. But what they did is they made everything private, which is probably an important step to take. And so it limited our ability to coordinate because the only people that could see the information were the producers or the federal agents that were working with them. So what we're working on is an agreement between the USDA, the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service, and the state to allow for sharing of that, but sharing it through the landowner because they're the ones that still control that. And we believe we can make at least a three-quarter step forward in helping those producers understand how to deal with wetland protection provisions at both the state and federal level. And Bill Hunt, our state conservationist, and I are committed to that. And if we get that done, and we will get it done, we will communicate that to producers, and we'll also potentially be able to use that to help streamline the state program that already is acknowledged in a statute that is in Minnesota Statute 103G. And so that's the short story. That we're working on it. The obstacle is the fact that we can only get information through the producer, and if we can communicate that to them, they will see value in sharing it, and then we can make some headway. So that's our objective.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Jeske. That's exactly the type of information I was looking for. If this process moves forward, would you keep this committee informed?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, yes, I will. In fact, it's certainly an ag policy issue. I'm sure this committee is very interested in that, and we'll give you an update as much as we can yet this year or as soon as we can next year if it takes that long.
And then finally, Madam Chair, and if there's any legislative action, I don't think there is, but there is, of course, something you'll suggest or provide guidance of how we might be able to be helpful in that process?
Madam Chair, Representative Morrow, yes, we will, and I'm sure others in the room, stakeholders, would be interested in the same thing. So,
Representative Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Jaske. I was going to ask about the RIM dollars again, and Representative Doty had touched on it as well. The issue of the fact that it was bonding money that had provided funding for that the last time around, and to leverage that federal money. I think this is a very, very valuable funding to provide to leverage that federal money, and the fact that the constitutional amendment says that the money raised through that dedicated sales tax cannot be used to supplant or substitute, but only to supplement. I do have concerns about using that source for that reason, since it has been funded in the past, that this would be considered a substitute and therefore would be considered unconstitutional. And then we'd also lose not only the funding from the state, but also the $15 million or whatever it is that we're able to leverage from the federal government. And it's not even dollar for dollar, is it? It's how much state money would be necessary in order to leverage this $15 million. And the second part of the question would be just wondering what your thoughts are as far as the dedicated funding as a source of revenue for this.
Madam Chair, Representative Eakin, the ratio is for every dollar the state puts towards this, we get about $1.4 in federal funding that would be bringing that in with in a package with our state program. So it's a good deal, so to speak. I think you're right about that. To your question about traditional funding sources, last year it was funded with bonding. But there's years when there's been no funding. And so, I don't have the chart for you. I could certainly get that for you if you want to see the funding for that program back to 1986. It goes, up, down, up, down. At this point, at least the information that the Lessard Council was working from would not prohibit them from funding something that had not been part of a base funding effort. Bonding is always been kind of project by project, and so at least the advice that they've been getting that I've heard about it, which may not be all of it, is that it would not be in conflict with that constitutional provision.
Are there any other questions? Comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Doty. Excuse me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Off the topic, but certainly a controversial topic. Are you wondering, like I'm wondering, if we continue down the road we went last year with the Green Acres program, if there will be more money necessary to spend on buffers, for example, because they're being taken out?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, I think just a little bit of background, and there's several policy bills going forward or going somewhere, being considered, let's put it that way, on that issue. Conservation lands are a big part of Green Acres, and my understanding is that they're going down the path of trying to find a way to make sure those are continue to be eligible for that program. They have been. They may need to be more targeted. I think it's also important to understand that one of the things in that bill that was passed is they identified CRP, which is a conservation reserve program, the federal program, as a conservation program, and of course it's named a conservation program, but the reality is that it's actually an agricultural program where it's temporary contracts, not even easements or anything else, that are going to be ultimately considered for another purpose, for the original purpose again someday, which is agricultural production. So I think being much more definitive about that is important, and we're monitoring it, but we're not directly involved in the middle of it, Representative Doty, so I can't give you all of the details you might be looking for, but we are aware that conservation has been eligible for it, and we hope that it will continue to be.
Madam Chair, if I could, I just wanted to, I should have done this from the beginning, but as you'll see, you're just going to see the Department of Ag portion of this, but just want to let you and the committee members know that over the last several years, we've worked very closely interagency with several agencies, and sort of how all the pieces of the puzzle fit together is it all sort of starts with the Pollution Control Agency. Their lead role is monitoring, assessment, and listing of waters. And once waters are listed, they develop plans, and that's when DNR also gets involved in the plan development. When plans are done, that's where gears sort of shift to Bowser and us in terms of trying to identify how to improve the water quality, especially in agricultural settings. And then also, I think you'll see in the and the Clean Water Fund request upcoming is there's also a portion you'll see for the Department of Health that has not been involved in the past, but they'll be more involved in some drinking water protection issues. And there's also Public Facilities Authority and Met Council. So just for your own edification, as you'll see all these pieces of the puzzle start showing up in different places. But we all have been working interagency and making sure that there isn't duplication. What we're doing is just complementing one another.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? If not, thank you very much for helping us out.
And members, as I understand it, House File 797 is going to be postponed. From my understanding, interested parties are working on compromise language, so it will be rescheduled for a later date at the will of the chair.
The committee is.
No, I was going to have.